The following broadcast of Sioux Valley Voice was recorded earlier. You will not be able to call in during the next hour. The next live Sioux Valley Voice will be at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, October 15th. My guest will be Shalice Jorgensen, Medical Director at the Sunshine Community Health Center. You're listening to KTNA 88.9 FM, community radio for the Upper Susitna Valley. I'm Philip Manning. Today on Sioux Valley Voice, my guest is State Senator Mike Dunleavy. He's running for re-election in November. We'll be discussing issues facing the state as well as the campaign. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, you can call us at 733-1200 or send an email to dj@ktna.org. Senator Dunleavy, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thanks, Bill. Glad to be here.
So I understand before we went on air, we're talking a little bit. You're actually in Valdez this morning.
I am. I'm in the slightly snowy community of Valdez, and yeah, they've gotten snow pretty early down here. Everyone's been commenting on it.
Right. Well, that's kind of the way of it in Valdez, right? Early and often.
Well, they folks down here said it's unusual. It's just cool and getting this much snow this early, but they're certainly getting a jump on it.
So, yeah. Well, up here it is clear and chilly this morning in Talkeeton. It's about 21 degrees here outside the studio. So,
can you see the mountain?
I could see the mountain. Lovely sunrise over the mountain as I was coming into work this morning. So, nice, pretty day. Good view of the eclipse last night.
Yeah, good.
So, let's talk a little bit about you. I mean, obviously you're the incumbent for Senate seat E, as it's called now. Why don't you just give us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to be in the state legislature?
Sure. I came to Alaska in 1983 right out of college, and first started out in southeast Alaska for a few months at a logging camp, and then moved north and was a teacher out in a village called Koyuk by Nome. I was a teacher out there in the 80s until about 90, and then I went to University of Alaska Fairbanks, completed my master's in education. Moved up to Kotzebue and was an educator there for approximately 13 years. Then we purchased some land in the valley. I moved down to the valley and I did some work with the Massachusetts Central School as an administrator. And then I had a mother who was ill, and so I elected to retire and so I could go back and visit her. And I became the project manager for the Alaska Statewide Teacher Mentor Project, which is a program that helps new teachers to the profession coming to the state to acclimate and get the help from experienced teachers. And our focus is mainly in rural Alaska because of the turnover, but we also had some mentors and mentor teachers in urban Alaska. Then a couple years later, I ran for the school board, was elected to the school board, and then last 2 years as a school board president. And after being on the school board for a while, I wanted to continue my public service. So I ran for Senate in 2012 and was elected. It was a two-year seat because of redistricting and the census. And now the district has changed a little bit again. We still have the district that you're in, Philip, which is West Keller South District. That goes from just south of Cantwell down to Houston, out to Splentner, through the wood, going over by Church and Schrock, Sheldon area, Bogard, and then goes along, takes in Palmerill, Fishhook, goes up to Glen Allen, just north of Delta, down to Valdez, and Whittier is also in the district.
So there we are. Quite an oddly shaped district, and a big one at that.
A large one.
So, you know, and that's got to be a difficult thing when you're campaigning to cover a district that big. What have you been doing as far as ground game in the campaign?
Well, this is the third time I've been down to Valdez. Came down on Sunday. We'll be meeting this afternoon. Had a number of great meetings with individuals and organizations. I'll be going up to Chicloon for the area council meeting this afternoon, and I'll get home in time to probably wash some clothes and then I'll be on the road again, probably up your neck of the woods. I was up in Talkeetna Saturday for the NRA dinner, and I've got another engagement in Glen Allen this coming weekend. But I'm just going to be on the road between now and the election. Lots of driving.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. So I guess the next question would really be, you know, obviously you are the incumbent. So why, in your mind, should the voters in District E, Senate seat E, send you back to Juneau?
I think I've been pretty effective first 2 years. We sit on finance and on the chair of labor and commerce, also on education. And I think we got a number of things done the past 2 years. We're we're looking at a two gas line projects, which I'm sure are going to merge here shortly. I think I've been a pretty good listener. I've been up to Talkeetna several times for community meetings, ranging from sewer and water issues to the dam to some of the other bills that were run in the legislature. I got to know a lot of good folks up there. So basically, I think I've been effective. I've been involved in public service basically my entire life. I consider my career as an educator as part of the public service process. And I just want to keep serving the public and being their voice in Juneau.
Okay. And if you were to be reelected and head back to Juneau a little bit later on this winter, what would be at the top of your priority list once session comes back in?
It would be energy in the budget. Wherever I go, I'm getting folks. It's a common theme everywhere. Trying to get our energy costs lowered and coming up with some different ways to power Alaska and power these communities. A lot of folks are putting their hope on the gas pipeline, and hopefully this will work out and it'll go the way we want it to. And that'll definitely provide a cheaper, abundant, low-cost energy. But we need to be looking at other things, too, such as closing the gas between our inner tides and possibly other sources of energy or other methods to lower the cost of fuel. We've had in place for some time with AHFC a way to weatherize your house and lower your cost at your home. But that's going to be number one. And then the budget. We're going to have to reduce the budget in some areas. And that'll be those two. I think those two issues will be a priority.
Okay. I don't know if you're hearing this at your end. We're getting a little bit of
I'm hearing a lot of feedback.
Yeah, it was. It's the every once in a while the hybrid unit makes a little bit of a UFO noise, but hopefully that I think I've got that tweaked a little bit, so it may not be.
You're not as far as me.
So let's talk a little bit now. The state was looking at the voters are looking at four ballot questions this election cycle. The first of which has already been voted on, and that was to The vote was whether or not to repeal the current oil tax regime that was passed in SB 21, known as MAPA. That was defeated, which means that the new system will stay in place, at least for now. How do you feel about the outcome of that, and what does that mean as far as the budget, which you said is one of your big priorities, and which I'm also hearing from all of the candidates thus far. What impact does that have, and do you think it was the right decision?
I still think it was the right decision. It wasn't an easy decision for the folks that voted for it in the Senate. Keep in mind it was it passed 11-9, and a number of folks that voted for it, including myself, are going to keep an eye on where the investment goes and how the oil companies invest. And we're expecting and anticipating that there'll be a lot of investment in Alaska. If things were to go sideways and that were not to occur, and people, their worst fears were realized that possibly the oil companies are not going to take Alaska seriously, and then I think you'll see a number of us take a look at the taxation system that we have in place for them. But I'm fairly confident in discussions that we've had that they will invest in Alaska. We should know here in the next year or two And what I mean by that is there's going to be a lot of routine investment that is already planned. But I'm talking about stuff in the board level, in which strategically, not just tactically, but strategically, they're focused on Alaska. Last month, there was a report that Cook Inlet, as you remember, was more than 2 years ago that we had the three mayors, Anchorage, Kenai, and the Matthew. We have commercials running that, you know, in the event of a brownout, this is how you should turn down your heat and check your stoves, et cetera, because up until that point, there was a feeling that the inlet was running out of gas. And in August, report came out that gas, both gas and oil production are up significantly in Cook Inlet. I think that's an example of where if there's an environment created for investment and new technologies, it can turn things around. So I'm optimistic, but I'm going to keep a close watch on things to make sure that Alaska's benefit from this this bill that was passed.
Okay. And the second ballot proposition, the rest of these are all going to appear on the ballot with you in November. So the first of those is Proposition 2, which is an effort to have the state regulate marijuana in the same way or in a similar way to how it regulates alcohol, which would essentially legalize recreational marijuana in the state and as well as some other things regarding distribution and growth and stuff like that. Where do you fall on Proposition 2?
Well, with all the propositions and initiatives, unlike some of my peers, I actually appreciate the robust initiative and referendum process Alaska has. I give folks a chance to participate in a kind of a direct democracy process. So with that said, I have no issue with any of these items being on the ballot. With regard to marijuana, I think it'd be a huge change for Alaska. Right now, we have marijuana in Alaska that's decriminalized, and that means different things to different people, and a lot of folks aren't sure exactly how that process works. But Colorado and Washington have legalized marijuana. There's a difference between legalization and decriminalization. Long story short, I'm going to be a no vote on that particular item. Only because I want to see Colorado and Washington run this new concept for a little while to see exactly how it turns out. I'd like to see how Washington and Colorado work out the bugs and what issues they deal with, because I think it's going to benefit Alaska to watch what they do over the next year or two. And again, if people want to come back and visit the legalization of that process, or excuse me, marijuana, I think we'd have more information, be better informed as to what the potential outcomes are going to be. So for this go-around, I'm going to be a no. I want to watch what happens in Washington, Colorado.
Okay, so a no vote this go-around, but maybe willing to reconsider in the future based on what happens.
Yeah, we'll see how things work out.
Okay. Proposition 3 is for an increase in the minimum wage that would, over the next couple of years, take it up to $9.75 and then peg it to inflation. You know, there was an effort in the state legislature last session to put through a bill that would have done something similar that then got taken out, you know, in favor of having the ballot proposition voted on in November. Where are you at as far as a minimum wage increase?
Well, yeah, the process got as far as the House. It never really came over to the Senate. I think most people want folks to be able to make a decent living. I struggle with the concept of not allowing the market to determine salaries, wages. You know, that's one I still struggle with. Again, I think people should make a decent living. I don't know how folks can make a decent living, even at the proposed increased, especially in Alaska. I don't know how it's going to impact, for example, high school students or college students, if it's going to squeeze them out of the market or not. I'm not exactly sure how it's going to impact prices of products and services for consumers. So I don't want to sound like a politician. I'm still thinking this through. I'm pretty sure it's going to pass because I think most people want it. I just struggle with the fact that the government's imposing a wage level on all Alaska businesses and workers.
Okay. The polling data suggests that you probably are right in the supposition that it's likely to pass. I think it generally polls 60% plus, which in a poll is huge. But and then finally, the Proposition 4 has been dubbed the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative, and that one, for the listeners' benefit, would give the state legislature a say or approval or disapproval of mining projects in the Bristol Bay region. And this one, I mean, obviously there's a lot of eyes on Pebble when it comes to this, but could have other ramifications as well. What do you see as far as Proposition 4 goes?
You know, from what I've been told, I think it's one of those issues that probably has enough support to pass. I really do struggle with politicizing a process. I understand the issues involved with Pebble, Bristol Bay fishing, but I do struggle with the fact that we have a process, and if we don't follow it and we start to politicize the process, it's kind of a live by the sword, die by the sword concept. I mean, right now, folks may be focused on Pebble. I'm pretty sure that this particular ballot initiative is going to pass, but what kind of precedent does it set for other projects throughout the state? You may have a very sympathetic legislature and governor here in the future to take a hard look at these projects from an environmental standpoint, but what happens if that changes? What happens if you get a group of folks in there that want to use the political process to ramrod projects down the throat of the community? So I'd like to rely on the process as opposed to politicize it. Again, polling data seems to indicate that the yes votes are going to have a slight edge. I'm just concerned about the precedent it's going to set.
Okay.
And so one of the reasons I'm hesitating or halting is, again, there's a tremendous amount of feedback on the line here.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's actually cleared up on this end.
It's pretty bad on my end. I'm hearing a loud echo, but we'll keep going.
Okay. I think at least it's not going out on the air anymore. So.
Okay.
So that covers the four ballot initiatives that either have appeared or will appear. My guest today is State Senator Mike Dunleavy. If you want to join in on the conversation, I think we are set up to take calls now. The number is 733-1200. I think we did get a call a little bit earlier, but weren't quite set up at that point. But we should be good to go now. So if somebody does want to give us a call, 733-1200 or email dj@ktna.org. Let's move on and talk a little bit about the budget. And you mentioned that it's going to be one of the big priorities when you get down there. Obviously, you're on the Senate Finance Committee, so if you go back, you know, one of the first things that's going to be looked at and one of the biggest issues that happens every year in the legislature. So we were told this year there was a lot of talk of tightening the belts and spending, cutting spending, and that, you know, we may be looking at that next year and in a couple years to come. So where do you see, and we can break it down into capital and operating because the state does have two budgets. So as far as the operating budget goes, where do you see an opportunity to save some money in the operating budget?
Well, we're going to have to look at some agency formulas in, for example, health and social services, if we're truly going to be looking at the operating budget. Because a lot of the increases are due to the formalization that's embedded within that particular department, and that's a huge department. We're going to have to take a look at that. And you're right, we do have a capital budget and an operating budget. It's my understanding that a lot of states don't necessarily divide the budgets out like that, that they have kind of a unified budget. But Alaska has chosen a process a while ago, which we approach things from the two perspectives of operating and capital. I'm just going to read a couple figures to you. So in FY11, the growth in the operating budget was about 6.6% per year. moving forward to FY14 and 15, and FY14 was about 1.3%, and FY15 it was 1.1%. So there's been an attempt to start to ratchet down the operating budget. The capital budgets have been cut significantly. And what I'd like folks to also know is last year, if it weren't for the $3 billion move into the tourist PERS system, if it weren't for a couple huge capital projects that were kind of dropped in our lap, that being a SLAM building in Juneau, we had two partly finished engineering buildings for the University of Alaska that were in the $40 to $60 million range. And then we also had a power plant replacement cost for the University of Alaska up in Fairbanks, which is going to cost close to $250 million. And apparently it's a pretty complex, sophisticated system. So these one-time items, if they were not in the budget, would have cut significantly. And so we're anticipating, now that we've lowered payments into the tourist PERS system through that infusion of $3 billion, and we've already appropriated money for these other projects to be worked on, I would anticipate, I have not heard one legislator, to be honest with you, and I most folks I run into, I think we're all in agreement that the budget needs to be ratcheted down. So I think we have to look at half. There are some other items, some fuel budget items, some travel items. Agencies such as the university are going to have to look at their budgets as well. But I think everything's going to be on the table for discussion. And I would be not just surprised, but shocked if we didn't leave this session with a significantly reduced overall budget.
Okay. And, I mean, as far as that goes, you know, the state, you mentioned a couple of big projects that were in progress, and I remember those, the engineering and buildings and then the power plant for UA. The state also has a number of large projects, at least, under discussion at this point, one of which is the Kinnickarm Crossing. There was a new financing plan for that passed last year that makes that contingent on some competitive federal loans. You've also got some other big projects, including one that everybody up here pays attention to, and that's Susitna-Watonna, which was another $20 million last year and still has, you know, a full field season of studies yet to do. As far as that goes, I mean, where do you put Susitna on the priority list for capital projects?
You know, very good question. We've got a number of, as you said, a number of issues that we're looking at. I think we're going to have a discussion this session regarding a comprehensive, coherent energy plan for the entire state. We're going to have to see where these projects fit in or if they don't fit in. I don't think we can be all things to all people. I think that's been part of our problem. We're a state of 720,000 people, smaller than many counties down south, smaller than many cities. And, you know, part of our issue is not a lot of infrastructure, folks in far-flung communities with no road connection that have energy needs as well. So we've for some time, have tried to be all things to all people. But I think the budget picture, revenue forecast are going to compel us to get a little more serious in focusing on what is really going to work for communities in Alaska, what is not. And I think we're going to have to separate our needs from our wants, and potentially dream projects may need to be dropped for reality projects, for lack of a better phrase.
Okay.
So, I mean, things like Montana, in light of the pipeline, in light of some other capital projects that we've been discussing, I think they all need to be scrutinized and looked up to see if they're viable.
Okay. You mentioned the gas pipeline, which, of course, there was one of the big topics coming out of last session was the moving forward on the gas pipeline. And in this area, I know we've got some of the AKLNG folks over in Trapper Creek. You know, they're starting to do a little bit of the very early field work up here. That's a big project. You know, we're looking at a price tag between 45 and 65 billion was the last number I saw. Now, that's somewhat mitigated by the fact that you've got the big three oil producers involved as well. But the state's investment in that project is going to be not insubstantial. As far as the funding for that, I read something this week that there's consideration on the part of some that, or at least a proposal or a discussion of looking at the permanent fund as a way of kind of investing into that pipeline. Is that something you'd be willing to look at? And if so, or if not, at what point do we touch the $50 billion we've got in the permanent fund, if ever?
You know, I haven't heard that, to be honest with you. I've heard folks just in casual conversations float the idea that individual Alaskans could potentially put their earning dividend or permanent fund dividend possibly into a fund and become partial owners, such as a stockholder in that particular 25% that the state would have. But I haven't heard anyone talk about actually using the permanent fund from the state perspective, the legislature and the governor pushing the permanent fund as a potential source of funding for this project.
It's a very new conversation. I just read about it in actually there was an ADN piece yesterday or the day before where that conversation has started, not within the legislature, but as far as looking at the state's overall fiscal picture.
Yeah, I'd just hearing about this, I'd have a difficult time with that concept.
Okay.
I mean, to me, that's almost equivalent of using your retirement to, renovate your house or get a second home. I think there's other ways to finance this project.
Okay. We do have an email question from Diane in Wasilla. She says that she does live in your district. And the question is that you brought up the monitoring of investment in the wake of the repeal effort's defeat. She has a question about that. Says, we already know SB 21 effectively reduced average annual oil production tax rate paid by producers. This is according to Department of Revenue. The repeal debate largely focused on what Alaska was to get in return for the tax break. What she would like to know is how the legislature and your committee, the Throughput Committee, evaluated the effect of increased reserve value for leaseholders. She said, I was told reserve value increased by $40 billion for the big three immediately on passage of SB 21. Was reserve value discussed in your throughput committee? And how did the legislature and the committee intend for that increased reserve value to be leveraged out for the benefit of Alaska?
To be honest, I'm not sure what she's referring to when she's talking about reserve value.
Okay. I'm not really either. She said she did tried to call in and got voicemail that... maybe she'll give us a call back here. I think we are set up now to take some calls at 733-1200. We are just about to the bottom of the hour, so we will take a break for a couple of minutes here, and we'll be back in just after 10:30. My guest is State Senator Mike Dunleavy. We are talking about the upcoming election in November, where he is running for re-election in Senate seat E. We will be including you in our conversation. You can email us, dj@ktna.org, or call 733-1200. I'm Philip Manning. We'll be right back. And we are back for the second half of Sioux Valley Voice. My guest today is State Senator Mike Dunleavy. We're going to be continuing to discuss some of the issues facing the state. We've been talking state budget, natural gas pipeline, and things of that nature. So, as you know, kind of to stay on the budget topic and the gas line topic, you know, one of the things that made this project in particular potentially feasible is the participation of Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips. Where do you see the willingness there of those three to press forward? I know there was some hesitation. I think it was Conoco was the last one to sign on. Do you see them as signed on for the long haul, as it were?
You know, that's a good question. Those companies obviously are driven by a profit factor. They're constantly looking at the constantly changing landscape of gas in the world today, where it's coming from, how much does it cost to get it out of the ground, who's got it, who needs it. It was just a few years ago that we had LNG facilities in the lower 48 that were all outfitted to import gas. Now the opposite is occurring. They're being retrofitted to export gas. The Fukushima issue in Japan with the tsunami a couple years ago, I think, has radically changed the landscape for the Japanese in terms of what they're looking for a source of energy. And even with all of the gas being produced down south, I think Alaska still has a pretty good chance of executing some contracts, especially in Japan with TEPCO, the big electric company, because I think the Japanese are going to want a long-term supply of gas that's reliable, even though they have China and Russia to the north of them. I think they view those regimes as more unstable than the United States. So I think the big three, Conoco, Exxon, BP, I still think they're diligently looking at ways to make this happen because I think they believe there could be a profit in there for them. But again, there's a number of different steps engaged within this bill that was passed last year. And we'll be talking more about gas this session, I'm sure.
Sure.
Let's see where we're at.
I'm sure. Diane has called in. Hopefully she can articulate her question better than I was able to. So let's get her on the line here. Diane, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. Hello, Senator Dunleavy. How are you?
Hi, Diane.
My question relates to how reserve values were treated by the legislature when they were evaluating SB 21. I watched a lot of those hearings, and I don't recall it being discussed at all. And that, to me, that's very concerning because reserve value is the primary asset for each oil producer. It's the equity in their home, so to speak. And if that increased so dramatically with SB 21, that means that they then can borrow against that. And if it increased, I was told that Link Energy saw $1 billion overnight in increased reserve value, and they're now investing in projects in Russia. So my concern is, we already, you know, the SB 21, the repeal effort, is already a done deal. That that revenue is reduced permanently. However, those reserve values are used, you know, are leveraged to finance new projects in Alaska and elsewhere. And since SB 21 gave the producers a really instant equity in their that they didn't unearn equity, we should say. That how is that equity going to be leveraged in Alaska? If they saw a $40 billion increase in their reserve asset value, how can Alaskans expect to see that $40 billion spent over the next 30 to 50 years or however long in Alaska? And how is the legislature and maybe the throughput committee monitoring that and evaluating that? I can hang up and let you answer.
Okay, thank you. A good question. The TAPS Throughput Committee was the committee that was put in place the past session for 2 years. I'm not sure if that particular committee is going to exist in the new session. It may very well do so. But that was a very good question from Diane. So how do we, I mean, basically, how do we know if the oil companies are going to invest the money that they're going to have now because of the bill that was passed, SB 21? How are they invested in Alaska? How will we know if they invest it? And I guess more importantly, how will we know if that investment is going to increase production? Those are good questions because, as we know, that was one of the topics that was embedded in the overall conversation. That is, what guarantees do we have from the oil companies that they're going to invest, they're going to turn production around? And there were no guarantees in the bill. I think most of us know that. But the bill was passed in the Senate by an 11-9 vote. And many of us did not go into this, I guess, blindly. We know that there is a risk. We know that there is a possibility that the investment may not occur. We don't think that's going to be the case. And, for example, our office is going to be asking and looking at what investments are taking place beyond routine maintenance, what investments are actually being put into place and voted in at the boardroom level and focused on Alaska to see how we can turn production around. And the best answer I can give, I would say that within a year or two, if we don't see investment occurring in Alaska like we believe it should, then I think you're going to have a robust discussion as to how we're going to deal with that with the oil companies. And I'm sure there'll be a number of folks that will be looking at reversing this tax and going back to something similar we had under ACES. But keep in mind that everybody, at least that I talked with in the Senate, everybody thought that ACES itself needed to be changed, that there are progressivity issues, there are capital tax issues. So whatever changes would occur, and like I said, we have to see what kind of investments going to take place and what kind of production is going to occur as a result of that investment. I think future legislatures have the opportunity to do what's best for Alaska. The short story is, if we don't see investment, if we don't see production being turned around, I think you're going to see a number of legislators that support this bill look at something different.
Okay. And so, I mean, are you thinking in the somewhat near term over the next couple of years that investment, that's when you need to see it?
Yeah, I think you at least need to see those discussions taking place at the board level. Like I said, there is investment occurring now. How significant that is, I can't answer that today as we're speaking on the phone, but we're going to be looking into what kind of investment is going to occur and is occurring. And again, it's kind of got to match Alaskan's expectations. I think if it doesn't, there's going to be a big problem.
Okay. Well, thank you, Diane, for that question. Good question, deep question, obviously. We've got about 20 minutes left in the show, so we do still have time to take some calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 733-1200. I'm also monitoring the DJ@KTNA email address. So to shift gears a little bit, one of the other issues that the state legislature looks at each year is education. And on the Senate side, you carried a potential state constitutional amendment that would allow public funds to find their way to private educational institutions. Some viewed this as kind of the opening the door to a voucher program potentially in the future that was not included in the legislation explicitly, but that's where some folks saw it going. Do you anticipate bringing that back in this session?
You know, at this stage of the game, I don't see the numbers in the Senate. Last year, you know, from my perspective, we were somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 13, and on some days it was a possible 14, because, as you know, you need a large majority to pass such a such a bill. But right now, I don't see the support for it, to be honest with you. And if the support's not there, there's really no point in bringing it up. Things may change as we, you know, after we get after the election here and have discussions with folks, but as we talk here, I don't see it.
Okay. Also, on the topic of education, you know, last year the education bill is part of what held the legislature over time, getting that hashed out. There were a couple of different things to be considered, whether or not to increase the base student allocation, which then gets fed into a rather complex formula to determine school funding, as opposed to that versus whether to, you know, continue funding in these 2 and 3 year blocks or year to year. You obviously have a significant background in education in the state. What do you see as the priority, not even necessarily on funding level, but one thing I've heard a lot from school board members included is one of the biggest issues they face is the uncertainty year to year of how much money they're going to have. How does the state go about changing that?
Well, we're forward funding education over the next 3 years to the tune of $100 million increase. And I know there's been discussions in the back about an educational endowment. You know, this, as we go through the budget process, I believe that this discussion is going to be a large subset of the broader budget discussion. How do we budget our money? How do we budget our money for ongoing constitutionally mandated programs such as education? There's no doubt that it's been a difficult process for education the last 2 years. Again, I got into the legislature 2 years ago. A number of the things that we're talking about have been long-standing, ongoing issues that have not been resolved. And this discussion has been going on as long as I've been in education in Alaska since 1984. I think given the revenue picture, I think given the concern over the budget, I think this discussion is going to be a large part of what we talk about. What do we do with education? How do we ensure that it gets the funding that it needs so that we're not necessarily going through this process every year where teachers are pink slipped or teachers are laid off? So actually, I'm looking forward to that discussion, and we'll see where it takes us. But I'm sure there are folks that bring up concepts such as endowments, and some people may even bring up concepts of a head tax, an old school tax. Be prepared for all kinds of possibilities in terms of discussion, but I see it coming.
Okay. Also, on the issue of education, you know, when we've spoken before, we've talked about school choice, which was one of the things that was, like I said, was included in this constitutional amendment. You said the support's not there right now, but you have spoken out about the issue of school choice in the past. How does that view, with there not being the support, as you say, for the constitutional amendment, are there ways that districts across the state can do more of what, say, the Mat-Su school district has done, where, you know, they've got a number of vocational schools and there's a lot of educational options in this borough? Is there a way at the legislature to kind of export that to some of the other districts?
I think the Mat-Su borough has been a great example for the rest of the state. And I have to say something. You know, this campaign season, and I find there's one element of this is somewhat ironic. Folks that were opposed to allowing the people of Alaska to have a vote on their constitution regarding education, those same people oftentimes were quick to cite the Mat-Su Borough School District as having all kinds of choice, all kinds of innovation. What they fail to tell you is that I was part of that. I was on the school board. For 2 years, I was a school board president. And if you look at my history, I've been involved in innovative approaches to education for a long time within the public umbrella. I've always been an advocate for innovation, for creative programs to reach as many students as possible. So years ago, I was asked to run for the school board by parents. And a lot of people may not know this, but we had over 3,000 kids in our borough that were not being educated by our schools. In other words, they didn't want to attend our schools for whatever reason. It was a multitude of reasons. And this has nothing to do with the staff and teachers. And I have found that the teachers in the math too, and generally across the state, are actually very good, very dedicated to what they're doing. But it was there were not enough programs to deal with the distinct issues of individual children. And so we began a process. It had started before I got here, there was no doubt about it. We had a correspondence program. But myself and a number of board members and staff really began the process of trying to spur as much innovation and as many creative programs as possible. And as a result, again, our district is viewed as the innovator in the state of Alaska. I'm at the Central School, which had about 800 students when I first got there years ago in 05, 04. It now has close to 1,700. It's the fastest growing school in the district, and our district is the fastest growing district in the state. Hmm. So people want to come to our program. And some of the enhancements we did last year in the education bill involving charter schools and homeschools, I think are going to engage more kids. So really the whole educational focus of myself has been trying to engage more kids, more families in the process so that we have better outcomes.
Hmm. Okay. And so you think that part of what was done last year goes in that direction then?
Sure. For example, in the Matthews Central School, which is a homeschool program, mm-hmm. really an independent learning program, folks would get an allotment. And this has been going on for many, many years, maybe up to 15 years in homeschools across the state. They've offered allotments, and some refer to those allotments as public vouchers. So in the math team, for example, each student might get a $2,500 allotment to be able to underwrite their education. They can use that to purchase courses, work with tutors, get materials, et cetera. But what was happening was, under the past law, if that family did not use all of their allotment by the end of the year, they lost it. And when you have a system like that, you tend to spend the money instead of lose it. What we did in the bill was allow parents, families to carry over unused portions of their allotment year to year. And I think what we're going to find is that they'll be better stewards of the money. They will save the money, especially if they enroll children that are in kindergarten or first grade, in which the cost may not be as great. And they'll save that money for later grades, for tutors, different types of coursework, different types of distance-limited coursework especially, and they'll have the money to be able to do that. And I think the state of Alaska is still going to save a lot of money through this process, but more importantly, again, I think it's going to engage more parents in the public education process.
Okay. To keep it on education, what do you feel about the prospect of a universal preschool or pre-K for kids in the state?
Yeah, it's going to be difficult, right? We're talking about pressures on the budget now. I've always been an advocate of optimal pre-K for families. The question is, how would you fund it? And I believe that we started that process last year. There was at least one bill introduced by Senator French involving universal pre-K. But we have to look at how we define pre-K, what ages really is pre-K, how many years of pre-K, what approaches are there. Are there research-based approaches that really work? Are there other approaches that don't work? So when we talk about pre-K, it's kind of a catch-all term for everything from early childhood education to 2-year kindergartens, you name it.
Okay.
So I think we have to have a discussion as to what are we really talking about, who would really be involved, how that process would take place, and how much money is it going to cost?
All right. We do have another caller on the line. Michelle has a question about education, public schools, and vouchers. So, Michelle, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I had a question. You were discussing how effective public school choice is in the MATSU, and I'm wondering, given that information, what was your point of opening the Constitution to allow public money to be moved out of those public schools?
Well, first of all, the constitutional amendment in my approach was not to move public money out of public schools. The cost of SR9 really was $1,500 to put on the ballot. And I think there's a misconception. Nebraska in the mid-70s changed its constitution in which they basically got rid of the Blaine Amendment, which prohibited public monies to go to private schools. But they never enacted a program. So that constitutional language fits on their constitution, but future legislatures never enacted a program of any type. What SDR 9 would have done is it would have constitutionally protected programs such as the Governor's Scholarship Program and practices that we currently do in the homeschools, in which we buy coursework from private and sometimes religious vendors such as Brigham Young or Alaska Pacific University. It would have protected those approaches and programs that we have in place. From my perspective, it was never my intention to take public money and give it to private schools.
Okay. Thank you for your call, Michelle. And let's take a look. We've got about 10 minutes left in the program, and I'd like to save a little bit of time in case we've got some other callers. My guest is State Senator Mike Dunleavy, who is running for re-election next month. The number to call if you want to join in the last 10 minutes or so is 733-1200, or you can send us an email, dj@ktna.org. Let's talk a little bit about, I touched on it a little bit earlier, but the district-specific things. Now, I guess my first question is, we've talked about how big the district is, you know, from Talkeetna and north of Talkeetna to all the way down to Valdez, Whittier, that area. Now, how do you go about balancing the various desires and priorities of folks in such a big and diverse district?
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. But that's why I'm down here in Valdez right now and spending time with folks and having conversations with them. That's why I'm up in Delta, Glen Allen, Talkeetna, et cetera. You're trying to get an idea as to what is most important for people. And the consensus, for example, that I'm getting across the district is, once again, reducing the cost of energy. So that would be a major focus of mine next year in the legislature. Funding of schools, as you brought up, is also a question that people have. But, again, places like Whittier and Valdez, they will have unique issues that'll be different than Talkeetna. I mean, Whittier and Valdez are port cities. They're on salt water. So they have a different, a different background. If fishing is big, again, bringing in cargo and shipping out cargo is big in Valdez. Obviously, the oil terminal is there, and Alias is a huge presence. So you got to sit down with the city council. You got to sit down with the various groups. And again, you got to do what I'm doing, and that's going to the restaurants and businesses and just listening to what folks have to say as to what the issues are. But, you know, you're not going to be all things to all people. I don't think people expect that. But they do expect the government to help on those issues in which, you know, it's a traditional governmental function. But again, roads, schools, energy is what I'm getting from people across the district.
Okay. One of those road projects right now, actually, is the Parks Highway is having a lot of work done to it. And there's a plan for an underpass here by Sioux Valley High School. Then the funding, I guess, is not coming quite as quickly as anticipated, but there's definitely a lot of road projects going on up here and school projects. As far as energy goes, and I'll agree, I've heard a lot of the same as far as, you know, we hear constantly about the high price of energy, and it's even more expensive a little bit further north of here. You get up to Nenana, Fairbanks, places like that. You mentioned earlier that things like the Susitna-Wetana project, you know, the whole selling point of that from AEA's perspective is, look, this is the way to get, you know, to eventually get rates like what are coming out of Bradley Lake, where you've got very low rates for power. At the same time, we're hearing that, you know, maybe this gas pipeline project could be part of that discussion. Where I mean, if you were to prioritize energy projects right now, does the pipeline at the very top?
I think so, because I think it benefits the entire state of Alaska through export and enhanced revenue stream. You can strip out the propane that could be sent down the Yukon and sent down both the Parks and the Richardson for folks that are not on a gas line. You know, it's got the potential to heat your home, produce electricity. So I think most people would put the gas pipeline at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. But again, it's interesting. You know, you and I, Philip, should do a little question and answer with some folks. Whenever I get 10 people in a room and I say, what's the biggest issue you're facing? Again, they'll say energy.
Sure.
And then I'll say, well, how do we solve it? I'll say, raise your hand. How many are here for the dam? Well, maybe 4 people raise their hand, let's say. And then I'll say, how many are for coal? Well, a couple might raise their hand. How many are for this? How many for that? Well, when you get done with the process or the exercise, out of the 10 people, everyone agrees they want lower energy costs. So you really don't have a consensus of how to get there.
Sure.
And that's kind of the issue that's bedeviled, I think, Alaska for quite some time. But we're going to have a deeper discussion and see what is the best approach that's going to have a positive impact on most Alaska.
Right. Well, if you do end up having that sit down in Talkeetna, give me a shout and I'll probably show up.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
We got just a couple minutes left. I do want to ask one other question, and that has to do with something else that'll be on the ballot, not one of the initiatives, but we have a bit of a unique situation in the governor's race this year, and that's you've got the incumbent Sean Parnell, and now you have the unity ticket of Bill Walker and Byron Mallott, who are going to be opposing him. And who's leading depends on whose polls you believe right now. Do you see, would you be willing to tell us where you're falling on the governor's race right now?
Falling, that's a good one. it's a very interesting dynamic going on in Alaska, as you kind of described. I'm going to vote for who I think would make the best governor for Alaska, and that's probably a politician's answer to a political question.
Fair enough. Okay, so, I guess with just a little bit of time we've got left, if folks want more information about you, want to get in touch with you, how do they go about that?
Well, they can go to they can either go to the Senate site if it's questions regarding the legislative actions or things they need help with in the office. Or they can go to my Facebook site, which is Re-Elect Mike Dunleavy.
Okay. And the election is going to be coming up on November the 4th. You said you do plan on visiting Talkeetna again in the near future. Any concrete plans on what that's going to be?
We should probably have a schedule coming out in a few days.
Okay.
We'll let you know.
All right. Well, we're getting a little bit short on time, but I can give you, we can do about another 30-second pitch for why you think the voters in the Upper Valley should send you back to Juneau.
Again, I think I've been very effective. I don't tell people what they need. I go into the communities and I listen to them, and they tell us what some of their concerns are, what some of their needs are. And I take it seriously. I work diligently in trying to address those needs. And I think I don't think you're going to find a harder worker and someone that's more focused on representing the folks of the district and Talkeetna.
All right. Well, thank you once again for joining us here. That's just about all the time we've got for today. My guest has been State Senator Mike Dunleavy. If you missed any of the show or you'd like to listen again, Sioux Valley Voice will re-air at 7 o'clock tonight, or you can listen online anytime at ktna.org. Next week, we'll have a special Sioux Valley Voice with guest Shalise Jorgensen, the medical director for the Sunshine Community Health Center. And the next regularly scheduled Sioux Valley Voice will be on October 22nd with Senator Dunleavy's opponent, Warren Keogh. I'm Philip Manning. Thanks for listening.